Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's unprecedented reversal by Donald Trump of protection of America's national monuments, as he announced the reduction of the size of Utah's Bears Ears National Monument by 85% and the Grand Staircase Escalante by 50%. Robert Keiter, the director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah College of Law, and author of To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea, joins us to discuss the peculiar logic of Trump's remarks today when he said he was bringing the land back to the people from Washington bureaucrats, when it is the people of the United States who own the land in national parks being preserved for posterity. We will assess what the real motives for Trump's latest unpopular act might be, given that there is no evidence the now unprotected land is rich in oil and gas and minerals that can now be extracted. Could it be that this sick and spiteful man in the Oval Office is simply doing this to undo Obama's legacy in furtherance of Trump's obsessive racist hatred of his predecessor? Then we'll speak with Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and the author of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf, about the killing of Yemen's ex-president Ali Abdullah Saleh by Houthi rebels after he had accused them of idiocy for protracting the devastating civil war and had switched sides to join the Saudi-backed coalition. We will discuss the merciless Saudi blockade that is starving the Yemeni population and a proxy war that has no end in sight. Then finally, following a recent missile attack on Saudi Arabia from Yemen, we'll look into the results of an investigation by the New York Times, which finds that the U.S. missile defenses in Saudi Arabia failed 5 out of 5 launches in spite of President Trump's claim that, quote, our system knocked the missile out of the air. That's how good we are. Nobody makes what we make, and now we're selling it all around the world. Laura Grego, senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who analyzed the data, joins us to explain how the failure of 5 of the 5 Patriot missiles fired at the incoming Houthi Scud-type missile exposes the false assurance that the U.S. and South Korean military have in their Patriot batteries intercepting North Korean missiles. And joining us now is Robert Keiter, who is the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, University Distinguished Professor, and Founding Director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He serves as a trustee of the National Parks Conservation Association, and his latest book is To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Keiter.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to join you today.
Well, thanks for joining us, Robert, but it does feel like a pretty sad day when you consider that 80% of the Bears Ears National Monument is now being reversed in terms of its protection, and 50% of the Grand Staircase Escalante as well. That's a pretty sad day for people in this country who care about this parts of our country that have been literally set aside for the American people and for posterity and to preserve what's left of the United States that hasn't been developed. I mean, it's not a lot of wilderness left to begin with. Isn't that a place to start a conversation? I mean,
yes. Well, the president has taken an action today that's certainly unprecedented in the last 50, 60 years. No president has sought to alter the size or modify the management of a national monument during that period of time. And those alterations that occurred prior to then were mostly relatively minor boundary adjustments. And this is not a minor boundary adjustment, as you noted, with the 50% reduction in the case of the Grand Staircase Escalante and roughly 85% reduction in the case of the new Bears Ears National Monument. It raises the question of whether the president has the legal authority to take the action that he has taken today.
So there have been a couple of previous historical examples of slight modifications, right? But this is radical compared to the historical record.
That is true, with perhaps an exception or two. Most of the prior boundary modifications were relatively minor, based upon new topographical knowledge that came about after the original designation. There were a couple of fairly significant modifications. In the case of the Olympic National Monument in the state of Washington, to make timber available, to take it out of the monument for purposes of military purposes during the First World War. There was also a military exigency that justified modification of a monument in California for an airfield for training during the Second World War. There was pretty significant modification of the Grand Canyon National Monument that goes back to Franklin Roosevelt's time. That only ensued after Congress didn't seem to be able to get its act together and what the appropriate boundaries were, and after the president had convened a broad-based consultative group to advise him on appropriate modifications. The legal question that's lurking here is whether the Antiquities Act itself provides authority for the president's action, and he seems to have relied upon that today, given the language in the proclamations that were signed today, which asserts that he's making this change in order to protect what he understands to be the smallest area necessary to safeguard the objects of historic and scientific importance. And that language does come from the Antiquities Act, although the courts have held that presidents designating national monuments have broad authority to determine what the appropriate area is. And, of course, President Clinton's designation of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument at 1.7 million acres withstood court challenge, as did Teddy Roosevelt's designation of the Grand Canyon National Monument, one of the original actions under the Antiquities Act that was quite large and withstood judicial challenge.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Carter, who's the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, University Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He serves as a trustee of the National Parks Conservation Association, and his latest book is To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea. But what the president said today in cutting back the bear's ears by 85% and the Grand Staircase Escalante by 50%, he made this extraordinary statement which defies logic. He basically said, we're returning the land to the people that was taken away from them by Washington bureaucrats. Well, national parks and national monuments are lands preserved for all Americans, for the people. So what's he talking about? He's not talking about the people at large, is he? He's talking about some local people, local politicians, and most of all, from what I can tell, a bunch of ranchers and miners who want to get in there and exploit, and oil companies who want to get in there and exploit resources.
As you know, there's been a good deal of local resistance to both of these monuments when they were proclaimed here in the state of Utah. State of Utah has significant federal lands and a noticeable segment of the population, including many of the politicians, both local and statewide, have used federal land issues as a wedge political issue within the state. So I think he's making reference to local sentiment, which polls indicate is roughly split as to whether or not these monuments should be protected in the size that they were originally designated. The national polls, at least based upon comments on the president's executive order and the review process that the Secretary of the Interior went through, suggest overwhelming public sentiment for protection of the area. By modifying the boundaries of the monument, he opens the lands that now are excluded from monument protection to mining and oil and gas leasing. And that's explicit in the executive order, although there's a 60-day grace period. There's also some modification of the grazing provisions in the original monument proclamation that would presumably lessen the regulatory standards that would attach to livestock grazing. It's worth noting that that was not excluded from either of these two monuments when they were originally designated. So, yes, I agree with you entirely that these are federal lands. They remain federal lands, and they are ultimately the property of the people of the nation. This battle over local control of federal lands has been going on for quite some time, and this appears to be another volley in that battle. Whether it stands legal challenge remains to be seen.
So what is then the breakdown roughly in terms of people in Utah that support this rollback of the protection? Because I did see footage on television of fairly substantial demonstrations in front of, I think it was the State House in Salt Lake City.
Right. That is correct. There was a demonstration this past weekend with a crowd estimated at about 5,000 people objecting to the anticipated action of the president. That's reflective of roughly about half of the population here in the state of Utah, with the other half taking a different view of whether or not the president should take this sort of action. There's long been a strong anti-federal sentiment within the state that goes back to the early history of the state, and that's also reflected in this this issue. That is a bit ironic in the sense that the state of Utah has benefited immensely from the five national parks that are located here, four of which were initially designated as national monuments by presidents over local opposition, but have come to be known now as the Mighty Five and are marketed broadly, both nationally and internationally, by the state to attract tourism business. And so it's a bit puzzling to see some of the anti-monument sentiment that is here locally, probably springing principally from the more rural communities in the state that feel that the monument designations limit some of the types of development activities that could occur.
Well, Utah, of course, being the last state to join the Union, at least in the continental, Hawaii was, of course, the last state, but there was a great deal of local resistance just against becoming a state of the United States. So I guess there's vestiges of that. But how does this Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, somehow reconcile the fact that Theodore Roosevelt is his hero? And when Trump signed the executive order, he's standing below a picture of Theodore Roosevelt. So Roosevelt, of course, was the father of conservation. Nixon, of course, signed the EPA into existence, and that's certainly been under attack by this administration. So what is this peculiar disconnect here between Zinke, who's a rancher from Montana, who is an outdoorsman, likes to hunt, etc., has Theodore Roosevelt as his hero, but he's basically doing things that are the antithesis of conservation and preservation, the very things that Teddy Roosevelt stood for?
I would agree with you, as would many others, that it is puzzling that the Secretary of the Interior, Zinke, who does seek to compare himself with Theodore Roosevelt, has endorsed this action to alter dramatically the national monument boundaries in this instance, and has endorsed an agenda that is tilted heavily toward mineral extraction on the public lands, which of course also opens the door for large corporations to be involved on federal lands. And in addition to his conservation legacy, you may recall that Teddy Roosevelt was strongly opposed to monopoly and corporate interests and corporate control. So all of that is puzzling, and I suspect that the legacy of this administration, as it is emerging, even at this early hour, is not going to be one of conservation. It's also a bit puzzling to see the degree to which the administration has been non-receptive to Native American interests and concerns, as reflected in the Dakota Access Pipeline decision earlier, and now with the reversal of the Obama administration's Bears Ears National Monument proposal, which was generated by an unprecedented intertribal coalition and represented the first time that a group of Native Americans had come together to advocate for protection of public lands under the Antiquities Act.
Well, Congressman Raul Grijalva, a Democrat of Arizona, he's the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee. Just before this happened, before this decision was made, and I'm assuming he's even more angry now, said it should be clear this review, this is the review that Zinke, that he supposedly conducted, which apparently took input, but I think, didn't you say 90% of the input was against it? But nevertheless, they went ahead and went ahead with this decision. He referred to the review as a sham designed to let rich companies get richer off our public land and settle grudges against Presidents Obama and Clinton. So let's start with the money side of it. Is there a lot of money at stake here for oil and gas extraction and mineral extraction?
You know, it's a bit puzzling in that most people familiar with the geology of both of these areas don't see mineral activity, whether in the form of hard rock mining or oil and gas leasing, as being a major economic activity that's likely to occur on these lands, possibly with the exception of some uranium deposits in or near the Bears Ears area. There was a coal mine proposed on the Kapirowitz Plateau that was inside the boundaries of the Clinton Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, but there are very few people who think that it's economically viable at this point in time to develop those resources, given the drop in coal production and the drop in coal prices. So probably unlikely to see major mineral activity, although there is some oil and gas interest in a couple of the areas that are now excluded from the monuments.
But what I understand is not only is this area was being preserved for the American people and for posterity, it also contains in it the fossil records of so many dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures that I believe is the richest deposit in the world. And we've learned more and more about the early life on this planet as a result of the archaeology being conducted in these protected areas that have just been opened up by President Trump. What's the likelihood of that's pretty delicate work, and you've got a bunch of off-road people roaring around. You're not going to have too many dinosaur bones left.
That is a concern. Indeed, in the Grand Staircase Escalante area, there have been quite a few paleontological finds of dinosaur bones and tracks and that sort of thing. According to the words of the monument proclamation that President Trump signed today, he asserts that he's taken into account the studies that have occurred and drawn the lines in order to protect most of the areas where these fossils and other archaeological and paleontological resources have been found. The question I think that the scientists have is that may not be all of the area where these bones and remains are found. So he asserts that based on prior studies, this boundary adjustment is justified. It remains to be seen if that is accurate in terms of what is there, as you noted. And certainly there are potential implications for development or off-road activity in the areas that have now been excluded from the monument boundaries.
Well, just in closing, Congressman Grijalva mentioned that this could be about settling grudges against Presidents Obama and Clinton. We know that Donald Trump has an obsession to undo all things that Obama did, and that it's reached a point of a kind of sickness, really. Does that explain this? Because if there's no real value in oil and gas and minerals, and the ranchers, of course, may want to graze their cattle there, but if you do a cost-benefit analysis, it just doesn't make any sense. So is he really doing this just to get back at Obama?
That may be part of his reason. I hesitate to try to psychoanalyze him on that front. And certainly part of it is a fundamental philosophical view that his administration intends to be receptive to the views of local people here in the West and how they view and want to use their public lands. The fact that these lands are public suggests that indeed they are owned by all of the people in the United States, but this has been an ongoing tension of local versus national control over these lands, well, from the beginning. And that's certainly part of it, and one might postulate that President Trump is doing a favor to the Utah politicians, in particular Senator Hatch, who's spearheaded his tax reform proposal. And the president even suggested that in earlier comments. So I think all of those motivations may be at play here, and they in turn raise the question of whether this decision is consistent with the underlying purposes of the Antiquities Act or whether, notwithstanding what's written in the proclamation, it's being made for other reasons.
Well, Robert Carter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Carter, who's the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, University Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah S.J. Quinney College of Law. He serves as a trustee of the National Parks Conservation Association, and his latest book is To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the killing of Yemen's ex-president by Houthi rebels.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it evolves. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. She was a visiting professor and chair of the political science department at the American University in Cairo. She's the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, and her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Nice to speak with you.
And Sheila, when you talk about dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf, it's worth pointing out that the Saudis have basically prevented any news coverage. I don't know whether you saw the recent piece on 60 Minutes where they had to kind of surreptitiously get cameras in there to show the starvation that's going on, the widespread starvation as a consequence of the Saudi-led blockade. We're not really getting anything like a full picture of what's happening in Yemen, but we learned today that the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was killed in a roadside attack after he had switched sides in the Yemen civil war, having abandoned the Iranian-backed Houthis for the Saudi-led coalition. So clearly this is a huge blow to the Saudi-led coalition, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think they imagined that they could attract Saleh back into their fold because he was for many years, while he was in power, very close to them. And then they had a falling out, and he sort of turned against them when he joined with the Houthis. And I think they had imagined, there must have been negotiations for months on end with Saudi Arabia and also the United Arab Emirates, which are also actively engaged in the war in Yemen, to try to get him, you know, on their side. So he gave a speech on, I think, Friday night or Saturday. It was aired on Saturday, basically saying that he didn't want anything more to do with the Houthis, but he was willing to enter peace negotiations with Saudi Arabia and turn a new page or something like that. So they may have seen that, the Saudis may have seen that as an exit strategy to get out of this war, which is, you know, completely hopeless. They're not going to win it militarily. And now I guess it's back to the drawing board on all sides.
Well, apparently he was in a armored vehicle that was struck by an RPG fired by the Houthis, and then they shot him dead. And there have been pictures of his body in the back of a pickup truck. It's sort of not quite as grim as the end of
Muammar
Gaddafi in Libya, but there's that sort of, it smacks a little of that. This place is completely chaotic, right, Yemen. And the only winners so far, from what I understand, from this boneheaded and ill-considered intervention by the boy king of Saudi Arabia, MBS, are al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They're apparently gaining strength while our Saudi allies are going nowhere.
Al-Qaeda has done not quite as well in the past, 6 or 8 months, as they had been in the middle. The United Arab Emirates, unlike Saudi Arabia, so Al-Qaeda kind of prospered in the south, the southernmost part of the country, there for a while. And unlike Saudi Arabia, the Emiratis do have boots on the ground. They're not, frankly, all Emirati boots. So, you know, some of them are Sudanese or others who have been hired. But the Emiratis also seem to be pursuing some investment strategies, like there's the island of Socotra, where they seem to think they're going to turn it into a resort, and some other places. But the Saudis themselves are just squandering money and reputation. No blood, no Saudi blood, of course, but plenty of Yemeni blood. But the whole thing is a mess. There's such a shortage of strategic thinking. Frankly, on any side, that it's so frustrating, I think, for the Yemenis, the people who I'm in touch with, of course, are mainly intellectuals, but, you know, just trying day after day to see some logic to the Saudi-led campaign and finding none.
But meanwhile, the Saudi blockade apparently is very effective, and the citizens of Yemen are being starved to death, are they not?
Yes, indeed. And, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of attention just recently to the complete closure of everything, including ports controlled by the Emiratis. So, you know, guilt by association, even if you're not in the Houthi or Saleh Houthi-controlled areas, you'll still be starved. And this has been going on for more than 2 years now. So the aid shipments are the ones which were recently quarantined and prevented from entering the country. But every expert, you know, with the international humanitarian organization says, you know, aid flights are not going to do it. They need commercial shipments of food, fuel, medicines, and other essential items, and those have not come in except in a trickle for more than 2 years.
So they're starving the people, but they don't seem to be stopping food and ammunition and weapons getting to the Houthis, and they're supposedly coming from Iran, are they not?
You know, we hear that all the time. I've yet to see a single photograph of an Iranian weapon. I mean, Yemen was awash in weapons before this war broke out. Saleh had been receiving Yemen's weapons and stockpiling weapons for years. There's certainly no shortage of guns. So the extent of the Iranian transfer of weapons, I mean, that's the excuse for the embargo and the sanctions, is to prevent Iranian weapons. But, you know, people much closer to this kind of thing than I am, who really keep looking for these weapons, and we've heard rumors that this missile or that missile originated in Iran or had Iranian markings, whatever that means. But, you know, I'm in the camp that would like to see some photographic evidence of that. And I might add to that point that, you know, the ostensibly the Saudis are fighting the Houthis and the Houthis are backed by Iran. But if Iran is backing the Houthis, where are they now when the Houthis are really facing the possibility of annihilation? And you would expect that if there were anything that would prompt Iranian action or reaction of some kind, it would be the dire situation that there is right now for the Houthis. And yet we haven't heard or seen any moves from Iran. So once again, I think we need to be very skeptical about the Saudi narrative that what they're doing in Yemen is preventing Iranian influence in the absence of any real evidence of Iranian influence.
So what did Saleh mean on Saturday when he appeared on television blaming the Houthis and basically calling them, or saying that it's the idiocy of the Houthis that has caused this war to go on? And he's compared his years in office as dancing on the heads of snakes.
Well, he has used that metaphor famously many times. There are several articles about him with that dancing on the heads of snakes metaphor. He just likes it. And I think once he used it once and discovered that it was catchy, he continues to use it. What he means, of course, is that he's surrounded by people that can't be trusted, that are vampires or snakes. And, you know, that he kind of is above the fray. Other people have also talked, though, about, you know, the thing that a lot of people have said about Saleh over the years is that he's kind of a master manipulator. He's not really Saddam Hussein or Hafez al-Assad, you know, absolute dictator. He's more Machiavellian and manipulative and handing out favors here. You know, oh, I heard your mother is sick. Perhaps I'll fly her to Germany for, you know, good medical attention, whatever. And then threats also. So he feels, I mean, he felt a couple of years ago, in 2014, that he had been sold out by the Saudis, and so he teamed up with the Houthis, and now he feels like the Houthis have led him into a quagmire, and so he decided to accept what we assume would have been a very significant financial package from Saudi Arabia.
Well, he's not going to be spending it. And just in closing, Sheila Carapico, the Houthis fired a cruise missile at a nuclear power plant under construction in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. And previously in November, they fired apparently Iranian version of a Scud missile at the airport in Riyadh, which we're going to be talking about in the next segment, since the Saudis fired five Patriot missiles, which the U.S. sold, none of which worked. And, of course, Donald Trump immediately said what a great success the intercept was by the fabulous Patriot missiles that we've been selling all around the world that apparently don't work. So somebody's giving them pretty sophisticated equipment, aren't they?
Well, I mean, there were Scuds in Yemen in 1994. They were using them in a domestic civil war. So, you know, the fact that there was a Scud somewhere in Yemen does not, and I'm glad you're going to have a military person presumably more familiar with the weaponry than I am, but once again, I mean, we heard that was an Iranian missile, but I don't understand why, if we're sure that there's an Iranian missile, and again, maybe your next expert will know, I would have thought that there would have been some, like, photographic evidence of that. It's not the case that there's nothing like a Scud inside of Yemen. It's also not the case that no Yemenis are capable of modifying existing weapons to make them go a little bit further.
And the cruise missile that they fired at the nuclear power plant under construction, that doesn't necessarily have to be a pretty modern one, right? Didn't they sink a Saudi, or I think it was an Emirati ship off the coast there a while back with a cruise missile? So they seem to have weaponry, but it's not necessarily state-of-the-art or very modern. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Some of that stuff is pretty old.
But they know how to use it. Well,
I know how to use it.
I will thank you for joining us, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Thank you for your interest.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. She was a visiting professor and chair of the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into an analysis of the recent missile attack on Saudi Arabia that Donald Trump praised, that our Patriot missiles knocked the missile out of the air, when in fact 5 out of 5 Patriot missile launches failed.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Do you think they'll like this song?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Laura Greger, who is a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she focuses on the technology and security implications of national missile defense and of space security. She blogs at allthingsnuclear.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Greger.
Thank you for having me.
And we're learning now from the New York Times, who've done a study into the missile that struck the Saudi Arabian capital's airport in Riyadh recently, fired from Yemen by the Houthis. It was considered a huge success that the missile was shot down. President Trump said, "Our system knocked the missile out of the air. That's how good we are. Nobody makes what we make, and now we're selling it all over the world." Well, the study of which you were a part by the New York Times indicates that the Saudis fired five Patriot missiles at this incoming missile, all of which missed. And the missile actually landed pretty close to the, at least the warhead did, to the main airport in Riyadh. So those are the broad strokes, right?
Yeah, that's what it looks like happened.
So that's a pretty big lie. Now, I think our president is somewhat prone to exaggeration, to put it mildly or politely. But what are the implications for us? Not just that President Trump has claimed great success. Pretty much everybody else didn't. The Congress, our military, the Saudis.
Right. Well, I guess looking at this system, this is a short a missile defense system which is meant to defend against short and medium range missiles. And the evidence that I saw, so I was not part of the original study. I was asked to review the evidence. And what I saw was, thanks to social media, and people have their phones out at all times, people caught what sounded like an explosion at the Riyadh airport, which happened at about the same time as the Patriot missile battery launched five interceptors, which happened around the same time as they found missile body debris in a Riyadh neighborhood. So it looks like, for missiles that are that long of a range, the warhead, which is the important thing, which is the thing that causes destruction, separates from the body of the missile. And so there's kind of two objects. And it's important to get the right one. It's important to get the warhead that could cause destruction. And that looks like that landed near the airport, you know, within a kilometer of the terminal. So that, whether or not the the other piece of missile body was knocked down by a missile defense, doesn't matter, because we're not worried about bodies of missiles. We're worried about warheads. So whether or not knocked down that piece, that's not really relevant to whether this was a successful defense or not, because it certainly looks, by the evidence that I saw, that the warhead got through. And so that was five interceptors launched at this target. And most of the time, when I, you know, looking at missile defense, if one interceptor doesn't work, the next one does, unless there's a flaw that's common to all of them. And it looks like of the five, none of them intercepted the target. And that's, I was shocked when I saw that, because I thought this system has been in the field for a long time. It's had a long time to mature. It's passed through the Pentagon processes to get out into the field. It's being sold all over the world. This was a pretty big failure. So I found that pretty concerning. And this is a system that's, you know, it's not like a strategic missile defense, which is a more of a theoretical concept meant to defend against long, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles, which we never anticipate being used, but this is something that's meant to defend against missiles that one anticipates being used. So, yeah.
So, but this SCUD missile, or SCUD-type mm-hmm. missile that the Houthis have, it's believed to be an Iranian Burkhan-2, which is mm-hmm. a variant of the SCUD missile. It doesn't have a MIRVed warhead. This is a warhead that's intact with the body. It doesn't separate before impact. So what you're telling us is that it's likely that one of the missiles may have, one of the Patriots may have hit it, but they didn't hit the right part of it, or they didn't disable the important part of it, which is the warhead. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, there, it could be two things, and so I don't know the details about the Scud missile, but we think that missiles that go that distance, that can go that far, they need to separate the warhead. So it's not MIRVed. There aren't many different
right.
warheads. There's one warhead and one missile body. So whether or not it remained intact and the Patriot missile just hit the body, but the warhead was left free to go towards its target, or whether the two things separated and there were two targets and the system chose the wrong one and hit it, or whether it never hit anything at all. All three of those things are a failure of the system to protect.
Well, that is indeed the case, in spite of all of the braggadocio about what a great success
yeah.
it was. And again, I'm speaking with Laura Greger, who's a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she focuses on the technology and security implications of national missile defense and of space security. And she blogs at allthingsnuclear.org. So we're not hearing anything from the Saudis, right? The New York Times has done independent analysis, starting with the cell phone video of the impact on the airport. Apparently, passengers at the airport heard it and felt the shock waves, because it was pretty close, wasn't it, to one of the terminals?
Yeah, it was about a kilometer from one of the terminals.
So, and then other stuff, what are satellite pictures and the evidence is, did anybody get to where the missile body was found in the suburbs? Saudi Arabia is an extremely difficult country to report from. It's a very, very closed state. So I'm wondering how the evidence was gathered, since you saw some of the evidence.
Yeah. So the so I don't know the provenance of the pictures of the missile body, but I think it fell near a school. And so the photos that I saw were essentially the pieces that they'd found, and they assembled them to in the order that it looked like they would recreate the missile body. And there were pieces missing, which is why that's one indication that, well, either it broke up catastrophically and we missed some pieces, or the interceptor hit the missile body, which isn't, you know, the right piece to hit. I don't know. And so the evidence for the missile, for the warhead hitting near the airport, was, you know, there were a bunch of people at the airport and they heard it, and people are on their phones, and you could hear them say, oh my God, something just exploded. Then there were emergency vehicles. The satellite pictures didn't provide enough detail to see a crater. And what they did was, you know, the day before, you know, there was a bunch of area that's pretty undisturbed, probably sand, just like a sepia-toned land. And then after that day, it was clearly disturbed. And the authors, the analysts who did this work, suggested that that was the presence of lots of emergency vehicles kicking up stuff. There's also, you know, a picture of a smoke plume that is consistent with a warhead hitting. So then the Patriot launches. It looked like somebody from their car just stepped out of their car and took a cell phone video and saw. And they took a picture of the Patriot interceptors leaving, and you could see them
one after the other. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right?
Well, you could see 4, and you could hear 5. I think it took them a minute to get their phone out.
Right. So, but what's significant about this is that there's a lot of analysts are saying now that there's a possibility that, as far as the White House is concerned about North Korea, they've given themselves a 3-month window to prevent the North Koreans from launching an intercontinental ballistic missile on the United States. That seems to be, apparently for the longest time, Donald Trump's been asking or demanding of his military people that he wants to do something, militarily speaking. not diplomatically. He does name-calling in that regard. But in terms of actually doing something to stop the North Koreans, he's been quite adamant, and they keep saying that options aren't very good. Now you're hearing basically that within 3 months they're going to do something. A lot of people, General Barry McCaffrey, for example, former U.S. general, keeps saying that there'll be a war in the spring, early summer. So we're heading in that direction in North Korea. And Senator Lindsey Graham is now talking about getting U.S. dependents out, not sending any more in, dependents of military personnel in particular. There are 30,000 to 40,000 American soldiers and considerably more dependents. Those people that Lindsey Graham is talking about getting out of South Korea in the event that there is a war, they're protected by this same missile system, aren't they? So are the South Koreans, the Patriot missile system, in terms of incoming short-range missiles from North Korea.
Well, sure. Here's the problem with that, or there's many problems with this whole line of thinking of moving towards a military approach to this crisis. Seoul is in reach of not just short-range ballistic missiles, it's in reach of lots of artillery from North Korea, so against which Patriot missile defenses are, or any missile defense is not useful. South Korea is very vulnerable. Many people are very vulnerable to an attack from North Korea. And there's, I think, in general, a real desire to escape from mutual vulnerability by increasing applications of technology like missile defenses. It doesn't fix the essential problem that's clearly going to need a diplomatic solution. There's clearly going to need to be serious sustained engagement, serious creative thinking about how to ratchet down the temperature. I'm less concerned about a deliberate step into war, a deliberate nuclear attack, than I am about stumbling into one and not knowing how to manage a crisis. We don't have good relationships. We don't have good contacts with North Korea to manage a crisis. So that's, to me, I think, particularly concerning.
Well, if you add, it's not just that there's no diplomatic efforts underway, none that we know of, and no contacts between the U.S. and North Korea. There's been a kind of reciprocal name-calling going on between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. And we know that Kim Jong-un is very sensitive to being ridiculed. They hacked into the Sony movie databases in order to try and shut down a comedy made about North Korea, or making fun of, not the dear leader, whatever he's called. So that's one aspect of it. But the extraordinarily stupid thing on our part is that the North Koreans have been for over five decades preparing for the ultimate war with the United States, their sworn enemy, which, you know, they've been propagandized and trained, and they run into tunnels and they've developed drills. And that's all they've been doing for over 50 years, waiting for this day. So the idea that somehow you're going to catch these people by surprise and knock out this missile threat through some Buck Rogers technical fix is so reckless and so dangerous. But the issue that you're bringing up here is that the missile defense that exists in South Korea is a completely false assurance.
Well, here's the thing is, I'm concerned about that. There's a number of missile defenses in South Korea. For example, the THAAD missile defense is near the south. It's not set up to protect Seoul, but it's set up to protect ports and military bases in the south. That's a less mature system than the Patriot, which we just saw fail. And again, shorter range missiles are plentiful, you know, much more so than ICBMs. They're cheaper. You can make them faster. We expect there are, you know, maybe hundreds of those. So even should missile defenses in South Korea work perfectly and as designed, they're vulnerable to being overwhelmed by many, many missiles. So they're not a solution. They're not a shield in that sense, and I don't think anyone should be thinking about them. And so I'm concerned, again, when you pull back even further, when our when President Trump says, when he's speaking about strategic missile defenses, that they're effective 97% of the time, that's just not true. It's not true in any real sense. North Korea is steadily working, and it's organized its economy, as you mentioned, organized its economy around being able to do these things and hold the United States at risk as a way to deter the United States from invading. And so if you imagine the North Koreans can build an ICBM that can carry the mass of a nuclear weapon, and we think that's a reality. So what we have is the ground-based mid-course defense system, which has been, you know, under development in earnest, has been fielded for almost 15 years, and has a test record of, you know, less than 50%, even in the best optimal testing conditions. When everything's set up to make it just right, it still doesn't work very well. And, you know, real-world conditions are not set up for everything to look just right. A determined adversary will set things up to be as complicated and difficult as possible, and we're not testing the system like that. So, you know, and that's, you have to, you know, I would hope that our president's advisors are advising him faithfully and clearly about what those capabilities are, and that not providing false assurances to him or to the American public about the capabilities that don't worry about it, go out and, you know, poke the hive with a stick because we're covered with our shields. It's not the way to be thinking about this at all.
So looking at the three phases of a missile, the boost phase as it goes up, the mid-course as it goes through outer space in the long part of the trajectory, and then the terminal phase as it comes down onto its target. Now, the Patriot, I understand, is designed for the terminal phase. The THAAD is for the mid-course. Is there anything that the U.S. has for the boost phase? Because they're not that far from, in North Korea, they're not that far from where the missiles are launched. When does THAAD come into play? And as you point out, THAAD is even tested less than the Patriot that's supposed to work and been sold all around the world and just failed 5 out of 5 just last November in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. So boost phase, as you mentioned, so there's not only different regions of missiles. When boost phase is when they're actively launching and you see the bright signal. That's a very short amount of time, even for something which is an intercontinental ballistic missile and meant to go tens of thousands of kilometers to go around the world. That's only, you know, at most 5 minutes long. For a short-range missile, it's even shorter, so you could never get close enough with a missile defense to try to catch those as they're boosting. So boost phase is extremely tricky, and the reason people are drawn to it is that it's a big bright signal, so it's something that, you know, it's easy to find the target because it's really bright. And when you're talking about mid-course, which is for a, so if we're just looking right now at intercontinental ballistic missiles, the strategic missiles, long-range nuclear stuff, not short-range conventional stuff, most of the flight time, most of that half an hour, 40 minutes, is spent up in the vacuum of space. And up there, your heavy warhead will move. You can't tell by the way it moves between a heavy warhead and a, you know, light aluminized Mylar balloon decoy that looks like a warhead because there's no air resistance to slow one down relative to the other. You can put tons of decoys, and there's lots of countermeasures and things you can do up in the vacuum of space to make it really confusing for the defense to pick out what's the target and what should I ignore. So boost phase tries to get around that whole vacuum of space thing by catching the missile just as it's launching. But to do that, of course, I said it was, you know, 5 minutes long, so you'd have to be really close to the launch site. So most of the time, a country that has an ICBM that the U.S. might think was an adversary, like Russia or China, has, you know, they have a big country, so their launch sites are deep within the center of the country and really hard. You can't get close to them. North Korea is a peninsula surrounded by water, and so there are lots of ideas for boost phase missile defenses, which could, you know, hover by drones or be posted on ships in the waters off of North Korea, far back enough that they couldn't be attacked, but close enough that they could catch a launching missile. So there are a number of concepts being talked about. It's still an extremely difficult technical problem. With North Korea, it's easier than it would be otherwise for a big country, but it's still pretty tough.
And as you pointed out, the mid-course phase is easy, just to float these Mylar balloons that, as decoys, they all look the same. And that's even difficult. And we've spent trillions on this stuff, and I'm not sure that anything that we have in mid-flight works. And in terminal, we've already seen the Patriot fail. I don't know what else we have in terms of terminal phase defense.
Well,
just in closing, give us a quick
yeah.
summary, because we're running out of time.
Well, you know, different missiles. So just to be fair, I think it was PAC-2, the old missile defense system in Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure if it's the new one. But in any case, a way to think about missile defense is not a shield. Most of the time, it's more like a sieve. But it's really not a solution. We don't have technical solutions to these big, difficult problems. And you have to be really careful about how you think about them. I think believing that they work better than they do can be really dangerous. It can lead you to act more aggressively. It can lead you not to pursue diplomatic solutions when they offer themselves, because they might be, you know, they might take hard work, but we can't let a belief that missile defense will save our bacon get in the way of doing that.
Well, Laura Grego, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Grego, who's a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she focuses on the technology and security implications of national missile defense and of space security. And she blogs at allthingsnuclear.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm